Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Michael Johnston, and this is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. Today, I have Dr. Bernadette Barton with me to discuss her new book, The Pornification of America, How Raunch Culture is Ruining Our Society, published this year in NYU Press. Dr. Bernadette Barton is professor of sociology and gender studies at Morehead State University. She is the author of the book that we'll be discussing today, as well as Stripped, More Stories from Exotic Dancers, which was published in 2017, and Pray the Gay Away, The Extraordinary Lives of Bible Belt Gays in 2014, both published by NYU Press. Her research and teaching explores contemporary issues of gender, sexuality, religion, culture, happiness, and the sex industry. Dr. Barton's new project examines forms of feminine power, marriage equality mobilization in Kentucky, and the relationship between happiness and transformation. Welcome to the show, Dr. Barton.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on New Books in Sociology.
Excellent. Could you tell me a little bit more about how you came to write this new book, Pornification of America, How Raunch Culture is Ruining Our Lives?
I would love to. This book explores the phenomenon of raunch culture, which is our hyper-sexualized society. And the raunch culture suffers from what I discussed in the book as a condition of inarticulation, which is that people don't have the language to talk about it very well. So how did I begin writing this book and why? Well, I started to notice raunch culture, I'd say approximately 20 years ago, some time ago. And so what raunch culture is this phenomenon where elements of the sex industry filter into mainstream culture, things like stripper shoes and Brazilian waxes and thongs and twerking, where girls and women are told that the most important thing they can do is to be hot and sexy like a porn star or a stripper. And this was really something I noticed because I was working on my research on exotic dance with my book Stripped that you mentioned. And so I was really aware of what actual strippers experience and what their lives are like. So I would be walking around and I'd look in Payless shoes and I'd be like, why is there a whole row of stripper shoes in Payless? So I was like, this was, and meanwhile, my book on the lives of actual exotic dancers was not exactly a bestseller. It's not like people wanted to read about what dancers really thought about their work. They were more interested in getting a lap dance, the men in particular. So this phenomenon was on my mind. I was paying attention to it. I was wondering about it. I was wondering why people weren't talking about it. And then in 2006, Ariel Levy wrote a book on raunch culture that I thought was just absolutely fabulous. And I assigned it in all my classes. And I was focused on it. And so my work updates her work. And also my work draws on interviews with people ranging from 18 to 80, actually, although the majority of the folks that I interviewed were millennials and in Generation Z. So one moment that it was really struck me that that I became just really conscious of the fact that I needed to do more about raunch culture, I write about it in the book, where I was in the classroom. It was 2013. I'd been aggravated about it for years. I've been like, what is this? Why is nobody talking about this? What is this compulsory sexualization, compulsory pornification? You know, why are people acting as though this is a good thing, when in fact, it's also a straitjacket for girls and women? Not to mention contributes to rape culture and sells itself under the false narrative of empowerment. So all these things are things I explore in the book. But this moment in the classroom in 2013, there was a young woman in the class, and we were talking about hookup culture and how hookup culture connects to rape culture. And she had had a hookup with a boy, and the next morning he had penetrated her without her consent. And she said in the classroom that at just that moment, she realized that that was rape. And she hadn't had the language to talk about it. And I felt like here is a gender studies student, and we are failing. If a gender studies student is not realizing that she's been sexually violated, what's going on in the rest of the world? So I felt just a real calling to research and write about this issue. I felt that it was important to give something to young people to help them navigate through the wilderness of raunch culture. I feel like the culture is failing young people and that they deserve better.
And then what was really surprising to me in this book is how some of your students in gender studies saw it as being a problem that had always existed and will always exist, and maybe not knowing necessarily how to change the situation. But in fact, please let me know if I'm wrong, but raunch culture hasn't always been around. And even if it, even when it emerged, it wasn't the same as how it exists today. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that is a really important distinction to explore. So this particular, but it's not surprising that my students think that, especially the young ones, because raunch culture is all they've known. All they've known, they've grown up their entire lives. Raunch culture is culture. So when compulsory sexualization is the culture, you're the fish and it's the water. You don't see the water. So yes, one of my interview subjects thought that. She's like, yeah, raunch culture has always been around. And I was like, not. I didn't say that to her, but in the book, I said, no. In fact, raunch culture is, you know, this idea that you should make yourself sexy, that women should make themselves sexy for men, actually originated in the 1920s with the beginning of courtship and dating, when men and women, young men and women, would leave the home to court, and women exchanged their sexual attractiveness for men's dollars. But so that's like the beginning of women looking sexy as opposed to just looking beautiful. But raunch culture as we see it today, I date to the mid-1990s, when the internet became more ascendant in all of our lives, when most of us started getting computers, were logging on, had email, and then of course there was internet pornography. And so raunch culture is the offspring of internet pornography. It draws on the ideas, the tropes, the imagery of internet porn, and filters into mainstream society. So the more internet in our lives, the more raunch culture. And you can see that as we go from dial-up to the YouTube's channels, to mobile phones, to social media. So you see a lot of raunch culture on places like Instagram and TikTok, for example, along with just in mainstream culture in movies and television and advertisements, magazines, for example.
And how has this new erotic marketplace continued to develop new ways to sexually objectify women?
Okay, so another excellent question. So before raunch culture, women were contending with the beauty myth, something that Naomi Wolf wrote about in, published a book in 1991. And so a lot of older women are familiar with the idea of the beauty myth, that there's this impossible beauty standard that we're supposed to meet, that we see in magazines and in television, that we're supposed to look like models and to judge ourselves according to how well we fit or do not fit the standard. But what raunch culture does in the erotic marketplace is add a dimension to the beauty myth, where not only are you supposed to be impossibly beautiful if you're a girl or a woman, you're also supposed to be sexy and hot, like a porn star or a stripper. And sometimes that means you're willing to have sex, but often it just means you look sexy. It's about the performance of looking sexy as opposed to actually feeling any kind of sexual pleasure or even sexual desire for something else. So that's another reason why raunch culture is so problematic. It's because it encourages participants to focus on the appearance of sexy, not the actual experience of feeling sexy.
So selling a product rather than embodying an actual feeling or sense of sexiness.
Right. And then the product is yourself. The product is your own body. So if you think about the idea of the male gaze, which I also talk about in the pornification of America. So the male gaze also predates raunch culture. And the male gaze is a film theory. So it's a G-A-Z-E.
Yes.
And it's it's a theory in which that looks at much of media as being shot through the lens of a heterosexual male eye. So what the camera's looking at is what heterosexual men are imagined to want to look at it. So the male gaze has been affecting the way we view media and how women view themselves, but it's only been with social media and digital phones that women have been able to easily create the male gaze on themselves, to self-objectify and recreate the male gaze on their own body.
Which is a potentially a product of cultural construction rather than individual construction or production of a product. It's something that was created by somebody other than oneself, and the exchange may even be more than a monetary exchange, and can be hostile many times.
Yes. Well, I imagine that a lot of young women who are taking sexy selfies would say they are doing it because they want to and it makes them feel good. But it's hard to separate out that individual interaction with the culture from this hegemonic force of ideology that's telling you you're supposed to be sexy and this is how you're popular and this is how you get likes and this is, you know, the way to success.
Yeah, it's an ongoing struggle that I continue to bring into the classroom, looking at the, you know, is it structure or is it agency? And it's
right, both.
So what is ebile? That is another term that the concept that you brought up in this in your book that I wasn't familiar with, and it caught my eye.
Oh, great. Well, talking about raunch culture is complex because it's really multifaceted. And raunch culture, is very much internet culture these days, or a big chunk of internet culture. And a lot of what you see on the internet, you will often come across ebile, which is hateful, misogynist, bigoted, aggressive, obscene comments that are said to minority group members, to women and to people of color, particularly women of color. So these are just hateful. So you just think about the comment sections of lots of news articles or and lots of different kinds of online sites when people can post anonymously there. So it's the work of trolls. Ebile is the work of trolls. So ebile connects with raunch culture in that ebile, we get used to ebile. So before it might have been shocking if you think about, I have a chapter on Trump and Trump being a raunch culture president. So if you think about Trump saying, I can grab women by the pussy, that sounds pretty bad. But if you're acclimated to ebile, where you're used to hearing much, much worse kinds of comments, and I don't know if you want me to share any examples. In contrast, grabbing a woman by the pussy, as terrible as it is, it's much less than saying X.
We can definitely continue to explore this chapter on politics and raunch culture. Not only was it Donald Trump and his presidency, but it was also people whom he hired into government, particularly, I think you mentioned the CEO or past CEO of Hardee's, and who had really kind of surprising commercials for the selling of hamburgers, and even sexualizing something as you know, every day as a drive-through meal at Hardee's. Could you talk a bit more about this?
Sure. Well, I opened the book describing a couple of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's commercial, which I'm sure most people who are listening to this have seen. It's commercials in which some, you know, very attractive woman, maybe a famous woman like Kim Kardashian, is eating a burger and practically making out with it. So it's like the burger is sexualized. She's sexualized. The burger is sexualized. It's honestly kind of weird if you take it apart. So the creator of these commercials, the mastermind behind it, is Andrew Puster, and he was Donald Trump's nominee for labor secretary. Right back in December of 2016, he didn't actually become labor secretary because he was disqualified for other issues. But when the press, including CNN, were discussing his nomination, he had them post a picture of a blonde woman in a flag, a American flag bikini, as his photo to represent him in the public, which was just super strange and striking. I mean, just think about, if you think about the people you know who are in positions of authority in your life, you know, someone who's like president of a bank or the PTA or the principal of a school, you can imagine their headshot in the local paper or the national news being a sexualized photo of a woman. That would be odd. But that wasn't something anybody was much talking about at the time.
And, you know, it's in some ways, it's while it's disappointing or saddening to see how raunch culture seeps into politics, national politics particularly, in some ways it's not surprising because the boundaries aren't so rigid to protect from such raunch culture to seep into politics. Am I right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And raunch culture is not a Republican phenomenon. I mean, it is on both sides of the aisle. So just like, you know, the student that I mentioned before who said, oh, it's always been here. It's the water and we're the fish. We're used to raunch culture. We see it and we know something is wrong, but we don't, or some people know something's wrong, but they don't really have the words to talk about it very well. I find that there's a real generational difference in talking about raunch culture too. And I really quizzed my interview subjects about this. So I remember talking to several people about what would your grandparents say? What do your grandparents say when one of those Hardee's commercials come on? Like, what do they say? They see that. Do they comment on it? Do they not comment on it? What happens when that happens? And you're together having dinner. And a few of them said something along the lines of, well, they won't comment, or my grandma might say something like, I don't understand why that girl needs to drag around like that. That's just not becoming, you know. So the grandparents would individualize the problem. Instead of seeing raunch culture as a social construct, they would say, there's a woman who's being sexy in a way that's inappropriate and that's immoral and bad. And I hope you don't act like that individual person there.
And not only is raunch culture and politics, but it's also seeped its way into Christianity. And how does Christianity and religion play in the perpetuation of raunch culture?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, again, raunch culture is everywhere. So you can see it in the it's important to be hot ethos, like the phrase modest is hottest. So this several of my interview subjects talked about seeing those pastors and people in positions of authority in evangelical circles talking about sex in ways that seemed inappropriate and raunchy as long as it was in the context of heterosexual marriage. So one young woman told me the story about going to a revival, and it was for the Greek students. So it was for fraternity and sorority students. And there was a preacher there who gave a sermon, and she said it was very much kind of like a hellfire and damnation sermon. And then he concluded it by saying he was going to go home and have sex with his hot wife. Like, that's how he ended the sermon. So yeah. She was just like, what the heck? Like, what is this about here? You know, with my super hot wife.
But you wouldn't see the same thing for female pastors or female figures in the church that talking about their hot husbands. And why not?
Yes. And I exactly explored that with one of my respondents. I said, well, what if it's a woman talking about her super hot husband and going home with have sex with him? And the young man I spoke to about that, his name is Timothy. He was like, oh, no, they wouldn't do that because it would be considered homophobic or homoerotic. It would open the door to homoeroticism was what he said. And I was a little bit confused, I'll be honest, because I was like, how is a heterosexual woman talking about how hot her husband is homoerotic? Actually, it like took me a minute. And I didn't say that in the interview, but then I was like, oh, could you talk a little bit more about that, Timothy? How is that? And he said that, you know, when a woman, that considering a man as a sexual object opens the door for everyone, for the men in the crowd to sexualize the man, and that is an extension of homoeroticism. And then that would be a problem. It wasn't that it was a problem that a woman's being objectified. It was a problem that it might be homoerotic if it was done by a woman to a man. So that was just a really fascinating distinction that he clarified for me there.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's something curious to me and something that I would like to explore further, exactly what it means homoerotic and how it, how it manifests, what are some of the consequences if such actions were carried out in the church? And they're not, by and large. I don't hear women talking about, but just because I don't hear it doesn't mean that it's not happening. But
well, in evangelical circles, yeah. Women are often not in positions of authority to begin with.
Correct.
So that's already not happening. Then it's normal to objectify women. People don't perceive that even as sinful. It's as long as it's happening within a godly marriage and is not perceived of as sinful. If women are made to contemplate the idea that a woman might be sexually attractive, the sinful part that's happening is because the men are having to contemplate another man potentially being sexually attractive, which opens the door to them experiencing a homoerotic idea, which then leads them into sin.
So it's boundary maintenance. It's trying, yeah.
And patriarchy.
And patriarchy, yes.
And homophobia.
Yes. So this begins in childhood. We talk about a fish in water and about how a fish in this water knows nothing else. What age do you think the children are first exposed to this raunch culture that we are talking about today?
Earlier than they can perceive an image, literally as early as they look at a screen. So I don't know about if you have young people in your life, but I know the young people, the little people in my life, they get phones or they get tablets, they get screens really, really young. So I think that, so can they comprehend the images? I think that, well, you know, I guess I don't know a lot about childhood development, but I would say, I mean, we hear stories, we see TikToks of 4-year-olds twerking, you know, people are taking videos of that and for a giggle. So that means that that 4-year-old is seeing the culture and reproducing it. Not that she understands what it means, but that she's encountering or he's encountering raunch culture that young.
Yes, and I remember one of the stories about YouTube about a young girl first searching for, some music artist, and then just basically going down a rabbit's hole, finding herself into pornography from an innocent YouTube search.
Yes, that's in the internet porn chapter, which is also hugely significant in the lives of the people that I interviewed. But I think she was 7 or 8, if I remember. It was the mom describing her daughter's experience. And the girl had done a YouTube search for Justin Bieber. And then it was like those thumbnails on the side that walked her into Justin Bieber kissing Selena Gomez, or Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez, and then eventually to them kissing, then to some big, huge, hardcore porn video.
And in some ways, it's not surprising. I have a 7-year-old daughter whom I, who she uses a computer and goes to YouTube to watch videos. And even racism on YouTube isn't so difficult to find. She found a Barbie skit where it was black Barbie and white Barbie, and black Barbie was poor Barbie, while the white Barbie was rich Barbie. And I caught on to it and tried to stop it, although it is difficult to protect children from being exposed to such a culture, is it not?
Oh, yeah. And I know that parents are doing the best that they can. That's another reason I wrote the book, is so that parents would have a guide, a resource to help them think about and negotiate the culture. I mean, I hope a lot of parents read it, because I think that there's a big generational difference in folks' understanding and experience of it. But yes, it's horrible. I mean, you can put all the controls that you can come up with on these devices, but, you know, there's always new ways to get around the control, like new programs from the institutions creating the content, and then curious kids can see, or maybe a kid at school shows it to other kids on the playground or in the classroom. So it's just, it's pretty harrowing for parents to manage all that. I mean, I don't mean to create a moral panic about it. I know that, you know, we'll make it through this, but I just don't think people kind of understand the gravity of how it affects a person to be exposed to this kind of content, and just the impact that, you know, so much exposure to social media and how social media can sway us in certain ways, you know, what the long-term consequences of that are.
And then, if a person is exposed to it at an early age and start to become part of this popular culture, it likely persists into middle school and high school in the relationship that is had between boys and girls. You write about boys who share explicit pictures of their penises through cell phones, dropping an image to others, or sharing it through other explicit means like email prior to cell phones, correct?
Yes, that's true. I have a chapter on sexting and dick pics, which again isn't, the sexting is new and the dick pics are even newer. So that's really confusing for older generations. So yes, there's like the students are sending explicit, young people are sending explicit photos to one another, and boys are sending unsolicited dick pics. Not just boys though, men are sending unsolicited dick pics to women at just ridiculously huge rates. And there seems to be some confusion about why that is the case, since women universally don't want them and dislike them. I mean, I'm not talking about one that's requested or in the context of a loving relationship. I'm talking about somebody, yeah, like a non-consensual dick pic being said. That's like, women don't want that. And why men and boys continue to send that and masturbation videos when unasked is a question I explore in that chapter.
As well as how girls are starting to participate in soap objectification in order to create a likeness or a sense of likeness in social media. It's that sense of likeness, I see it as a new form of cultural currency, a way to gain social capital through people liking or putting a chili pepper or flame response to a photograph. Could you talk more about this culture?
Yes. So yes, girls learn early on that a way to popularity and social capital is to self-objectify, to look sexy. They do know when to post. I think a good posting time is, you know, in the evening after such and such. Honestly, I don't remember. I don't actually know the right. I've been told, but I forgot. But yes, they know when you're supposed to post, when you'll get the most traffic. They take down photos that don't get enough likes. They will send sexy photos to boys that they like. So boys are not the only ones sending unsolicited sexy photos. Girls do it too. One difference is that usually the boys don't object. Like the boys like it more than the girls like an unsolicited sexy photo. But yes, they learn that from the culture. They learn that and they're rewarded for it for the most part.
Yeah, and it's interesting how it's becoming a a fad with being a with popularity becomes a person becomes a social influencer, and it seems that you know, even my 7-year-old said, well, that's a social influencer, Dad. I said, well, I didn't know that was a job. Now, of course, I know that's a job, but it hasn't always been a job. And it's interesting how it's becoming a new career that people can go into as a profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Instagram influencers, I have a photo of them. They're often, yes, they definitely will illustrate ranch culture and will have many sexy photos of themselves. But I would say the Instagram influencers also are always, they're working so hard to portray this lifestyle of success and happiness and perfect beauty in addition to the ranch stuff. And I think that is also just really hard for people to look at and compare themselves to and feel inadequate when they're not having a vacation in Greece on this beautiful island, and they can't get the perfect photo of them and their boyfriend. And so all that stuff complicates people's experience of the culture.
And Bernadette, one of the things that I like most about your book is not only is it the research that you have throughout the whole book, but then also this discussion that we had as part of what we talked about today, which was an opportunity for parents to read and to sort of be somewhat of a self-help and helping parents understand ranch culture and what it is and how they can work with their children to reduce it as much as possible, or even eliminate the harms that may exist to their children for getting involved in such a ranch culture that persists. So what advice would you give today for listeners when they experience ranch culture in everyday life, or how they might work with their children and in this area?
Oh, that's a great question. And I do spend the last chapter talking about how we can transform ranch culture. So what I would say to people is to find your inner guidance. So the problem with ranch culture is not that it's sexy, it's that it's sexist, that it promotes one kind of sexiness, a sexiness modeled after internet porn that is a patriarchal product, ruthlessly and relentlessly. So what we need to do, what I recommend, the path out of ranch culture is seeing that. Just start with perceiving it. Do you see ranch culture? Do you perceive it? Do you agree it exists? do you see it in the world around you? And if you see it, then what do you think about it? Like, what are your ideas about ranch culture? What do you think about making sexy selfies? Do you really, if you're a young woman, do you really want to wear a micro mini skirt and like super high heels that you can't even walk in or sit down in, that you're uncomfortable in all night? Like, if that's what you want, good. Make sure you're following your own inner guidance. Follow your own narrative. But you have to be able to know what your inner guidance is before you can follow it. And part of that is going to be perceiving ranch culture and being willing to critique it. What's also going to be extremely valuable for young people and for parents and for teachers is comprehensive sex education that is focused on not this horrible abstinence only sex ed where you don't have it till you're in a heterosexual marriage, but a real sex ed that talks about consent and pleasure and same sex sexuality and birth control and how to negotiate sexual acts, how to know what you like, how to be safe. So a really good sex ed taught in school alongside comprehensive gender studies education. So that helps us deconstruct traditional gender roles, that helps us, recognize, support, celebrate all different kinds of gender identities, that helps us critique patriarchy and take ownership of our own lives. So better sex ed, gender studies education, seeing ranch culture, critiquing ranch culture, being willing to speak about it and challenge it with the people you're around. Not in a hostile way, not an aggressive way, not in a polarizing way that's, just going to raise hackles, but when you can and when you think you can make a difference. So those are some of the ideas that I talk about in the book.
Excellent. That's definitely some stuff that I also bring to the classroom. And sex and gender, I was talking just the other day about getting into the conversation, starting off with the conversation, building a relationship before discussing these difficult conversations with others who may not even realize their own sexist behaviors. You know, it might even be something as subtle as benevolent sexism, where it's intended to be a nicety, but it's it has negative implications associated with such a nicety.
Yes, and I get that it's hard to challenge people on sexist behaviors, especially unconscious sexist beliefs, actions, and behaviors, because I've been teaching gender and women's studies for 25 years, so I have a lot of experience introducing people to these ideas and dealing with people who are defensive. But I think that one of the things that's emerged in the past few years, and certainly, you know, with the recent wave of racial awareness, is this idea that when somebody observes something in you that isn't perfect, that where you're making something that's unconsciously racist or sexist or homophobic, you know, and someone points it out to you, the best response is just to say, thanks. Wow. I appreciate your time spent helping me think about that. And that's it. That's all you got to do. Like, that's all you know, even if you don't agree, you can just leave it there and ponder it and explore it later. I mean, there's no need to have a hissy fit. Just be like, oh, yeah, thanks. I didn't know that. Now I know a little something more.
Yes. Well, thank you for your time today, Bernadette. It was a great opportunity to talk to you again. And I hope to have you on the show for your next project. Which leads us to this final burning question that I always have. What are you working on next?
What are you working on now? That's a good question. I have a couple of new project ideas in my head that I'm working on a project on marriage equality mobilization in Kentucky. So I'm working on a project around the events with Kim Davis. If you recall, back in 2015, she was the county clerk who denied marriage licenses to same-sex partners trying to get married. So yes. I have a project that's ongoing on that. And I'm also beginning a project on feminine power, which is looking. So in our society, in our culture, we often see power in very patriarchal and masculine terms. It's about force and control and domination and winning the game. But the fact is, there are other forms of power that I call feminine, like yielding and vulnerability and creative connections that people, including men and women, use all the time, that they don't label power. So what would happen if we looked at those behaviors, reframed them as power, gave femininity some street cred? How could that be transformative? So that's what my new project is. One of my new projects is exploring.
Yeah, I think of Arlie Hochschild and with you know, the second shift and the emotional labor that women put out, and mm-hmm. and how valuable it is, but often isn't you know, isn't on the Richter scale, because it's not paid work. But those skills that are associated with the emotional labor that is put out largely by women, but somewhat by men in 21st century America, still not to the extent that men should be contributing by and large. But those are some things that I think of when you talk about feminine power.
You're right. I write about emotional labor as what, you know, as a dimension of it. So good catch there.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading that book and having you on the show again here soon, probably a year or so down the road, right?
Maybe a little longer, but I hope that would be ambitious. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. And again, this is New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.